So what do you hear about the rise of Paul Ryan? And do you think it's a good idea?
That's a great question, Dave. I've come to know Paul Ryan a little bit. Worked with him a lot on the when I first got here, which was good for me because, of course, Paul Ryan's been here for 17 years. Even though he's only 45 years old, he knows the place inside and out. A lot of people know his story, that he started with Jack Kemp, you know, he knows the place. But Paul is almost a reluctant speaker.
Mm.
You're right to be a little pessimistic in light of what's happened over the last few weeks. The sudden announcement by John Boehner that he was going to depart early. The apparent rise of Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader. The destruction of Kevin McCarthy by certain groups that decided they didn't want him from the outside. Kevin McCarthy withdraws, and there we are left with no one. And again, Ryan never sought it. He was pressured into it. To your last question, then let's talk about what I think is going to happen. He has now decided, because he showed up last Tuesday, gave a speech to the conference with two great lines in it, by the way, that I will use someday and not attribute to him, I'm sure. But he, one of them was, he said, you know, I was asked the other night how I sleep at night. And he says, I sleep just like a baby. He says, I wake up every 2 hours crying. And he was trying to communicate that this is a big decision. You know, he looks at it as probably the last decision he will make in his political career. Because you don't, you know, even though Paul is probably on that short list of Republicans in this country that could run for president, someday, you don't usually run for president after being Speaker of the House. You know, there are things the Speaker has to do in terms of getting all these frogs to stay in the wheelbarrow, right? That it just doesn't always lend itself well to the presidential side of things. But he thinks it's this important that he's got to run. He put conditions on it. The conditions are that the motion to vacate the chair be adjusted. Not that it go away, but that it not be as easy as it is right now for one member of the conference to use that motion to, frankly, upend the majority. He believes it's an important rule to have, but that it needs to be adjusted. And apparently the 40-some conservatives that are named members of the Freedom Caucus, the majority of them were okay with an adjustment of the rule. Because three-quarters of them have endorsed him, which was his other condition. He needs everybody to endorse him. The Freedom Caucus, there's a group called the Tuesday Group that apparently they consider themselves more moderate. I've never been to either. Well, I shouldn't say that. I've been to some of the Tea Party and some of the Freedom Caucus gatherings, have not been to a Tuesday Group, but basically, he needed everybody behind him because he didn't want to have what happened to McCarthy to happen to him. In fact, that's the second great line, Dave. He, in front of the conference with John Boehner and Kevin McCarthy sitting right to his left, he said, he turned and looked at them and then said to the conference, I do not intend to be the third log on this bonfire. All right? So, once he got all those people behind him, I think now to your question, I think he probably is the odds-on favorite to be elected speaker by the conference on Wednesday, and more importantly, to be elected on the House floor with 218-plus on Thursday. Is it the right decision? Well, time will tell. For Paul Ryan, I'm the new guy, so I have no right to say it, but I don't know if this is the right decision for Paul Ryan. I don't know that you can make everybody happy. In fact, I know you can't. I give you an example and then turn it back to you guys. The morning after the Freedom Caucus announced on Twitter that three-quarters of their membership had decided to endorse Paul Ryan. They weren't going to endorse him as a group, but they just wanted everybody to know that a supermajority of that 40 votes supports Paul Ryan. I was listening to a couple of guys in the gym the next morning, and the one says, hey, did you know the Freedom Caucus has a Twitter feed? And the other guy says, no. And he says, Yeah, you know, I had a great day yesterday, so I wanted to bring myself down. I decided to read my Twitter feed last night, and the other guy says, well, that'll bring you back to Earth in a hurry. And the first guy says, yeah, and I saw this tweet from the Freedom Caucus that supermajority had endorsed Paul Ryan. He said, hey, and to the second guy, the first guy says, hey, and by the way, did you know the Freedom Caucus has a Facebook page? And the second guy says, no, I didn't know. And the first guy says, well, I went to their Facebook page and I was stunned. It looks just like mine. And the second guy says, what do you mean? He says, after the tweet went out about Paul Ryan, a supermajority of the Freedom Caucus supporting Paul Ryan, their Facebook page was littered with comments of, you sellouts, you gave up, you guys are worthless, you guys are terrible. So it really is going to be a difficult job no matter who's in it.
Tom, I've got a quick question. Now, this has been described by much of the major media as chaos, that when John Boehner said, I'm retiring, that somehow the Republicans degenerated into a chaotic state. Now, I have a question for you. Is chaos normal, or was it chaos at all?
It wasn't chaos at all. I mean, that's the narrative that the big media wants to use, and frankly, you know, we Republicans give them enough material, right? Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that we gave them the material to work with, but this concept that it just devolved into people fighting amongst one another, to your bigger question is that normal? First off, it didn't devolve where we weren't getting anything done. Business went on as usual. The optics outside of the conference obviously were not very good because you gave people the opportunity to say, look at these guys. They can't even run their own house. They can't figure out who's going to govern. But as far as relationships on the inside of the building, they were as strong as I've seen them since I've been here. The narrative didn't fit what was actually happening in the conference. On the other hand, one of my colleagues from Louisiana said when he was very frustrated after McCarthy withdrew, his statement, and I won't give the whole statement because it's I just wouldn't repeat the whole thing, but you'll get the idea. He said, look, guys, if we don't get this taken care of, the splatter is not just going to end up on us. It's going to end up on everybody outside of here, and it could impact the 2016 elections. And I think but back to your bigger question, Jim, no, it didn't evolve into chaos. It was people. People always are going to be struggling back and forth. It's the beauty of the way this thing works. But the inside, the business, just continued on as usual.
Mm-hmm. And we were talking to Rick Nolan on Friday, and we asked him the same question. And that's the, if you look between the lines, I mean, the checks are still going out, the lights are still on, the air conditioning still runs, the limos still show up on time. So there is something that's going along just fine, even though the outside image is a place in absolute disarray, it's just absolute chaos.
And that's correct.
You in your wildest imagination, you see people running for the exits and leaping off the railings and heading for the high timber. Back to the Freedom Caucus and the Tuesday group. And I did a quick Google search, I think last week sometime, to find out who was in the groups. And there was a couple of websites, I think one of them was the Pew Fund, that had taken some stabs at it, had taken guesses at it, but they didn't really know for sure who was in the Freedom Caucus or who was in these other groups. It's not like they keep a roll and they have a list of names and they have a list of people they've invited to come in and talk. Is that the way it is? Or
it's a great question. I mean, I was invited. First off, I think they do know who they are. Hmm. As far as a published list, no.
Okay.
I don't think they put out published lists. There are some guys that'll tell you flat out they're a member of the Freedom Caucus. There are others that are members that aren't going to be public about it. They're just going to there, but you'll be able to tell because they'll vote as a block on almost everything. It was interesting. They didn't the other day though. We had that reconciliation bill that Heritage was scoring as a negative for some reason. I don't understand what Jim DeMint's doing with his, you know, what's a good bill and what's a bad bill. But they typically tend to answer to Jim DeMint and the Heritage Foundation, right, which, you know, as far as a resource for those of us on our side of the aisle, the Heritage is one of the top resources available for conservative ideas and policy. But this other, the Heritage Action Network,
right,
which is their political arm, you know, not their educational arm, they score votes, and they for some reason they scored that one negative on Friday, and I think only 11 voted against the bill because everybody wanted it to go to the president's desk. You know what, Dave? I've been invited. I go to these meetings myself when they're having them and they fit in my schedule. But I did this when I ran statewide. You know, are you the Tea Party candidate? You know what? I'm a Republican. Mm-hmm. And these guys, you know, within the conference, I think they do this so that they can distinguish themselves. Some do it from the rest of the group, right? I'm not interested in doing that at this point. I know who I am and I know what I'm voting for. There are some in there, though, that do it because I think they like the media that comes with it, you know?
Yeah.
Some do it for really good, pure reasons, and others are a little bit more selfish. They're human beings, again.
Yeah. Well, who would have thunk?
Can you believe human beings can be selfish and self-interested?
Really? Well, and that's the other thing we hear, too, is that once people go to Congress, they change. They grow an extra head, and they're just not like the people back home. They're just not the way. And that's an easy narrative to fall into as well. All of a sudden you become this isolated group that just won't talk to anybody, and you fight with Democrats constantly and back and forth.
Dave, what you just said, that's why. You don't talk to anybody. The narrative fits if you just withdraw. The narrative fits if you don't stay in touch. I think really my short experience, we're going on 10 months, I think what I've seen is everybody outside of this place, it's a lot different than serving in the state legislature, right? You've got the pressure that can be applied from the outside, from special interest groups, is enormous. And I think depending on who you are and what your background is, some people, it's such a burden that they withdraw, right? Now, you had Rick Nolan on last week. Rick Nolan and I disagree on policy stuff, right?
Sure.
But you know us both. Yep. David, I've known you longer than I've known Jim, obviously, but you know that I like people and I like going out and doing the retail side of things. My understanding of Rick Nolan is he's the same way. Others don't do that. They withdraw. And once they withdraw, then I think that narrative, oh, look, they've changed. You know, they're not doing what I want them to do. And they've gone off the boat. They're doing things that we don't agree with. Well, if you don't come out and sit down with the people you're working for and create the personal narrative, you know, the relationship, it's really easy for the other one to take hold, and I think that's a big problem. I think it's more a reflection of the inexperience or inability or, frankly, the laziness of the representative than it is of what really happens.
And to let you guys off the hook just a little bit, I know a lot of people, a lot of folks out here who are almost intentionally ignorant of what goes on in Washington. I mean, it's almost like, I don't want to be tainted with this nasty stuff. I don't even want to talk to anybody about it. I don't want to learn nothing. And I had a long conversation with a former classmate last year, and she was asking me questions about who to vote for in the 8th district race. And I gave her a 2-minute pageant on, you know, history of the nation and the founding fathers and the, you know, freedom. And it was beautiful. It was gorgeous. Oh, man, I saw parades in my head. You know, it was wonderful. And then I looked over at her, and her eyes are glazing over. And I said, well, but the other choice you could do is just wait till 3 days before the election and choose on hairstyle. And and it went right over her head.
She didn't even pick up on it.
No, and she paused for a couple of seconds. She says, you know, I think I'll do that.
Wow.
It was stunning. It was just like, I gave her great stuff, and it was just, oh man, yeah. And it said, and I spent a little time with some aging aunts yesterday over in Wadena, and and they're hard bitten Democrats, and make any difference what Hillary's gone through. Well, I think that Mrs. Clinton's going to make a nice president.
Yeah. It is amazing, isn't it, David?
Oh, it's just, it's absolutely amazing. I mean, even on the trail, on the campaign trail, I don't know how many times I talked to people who are in their 70s and 80s who said, well, I've been a Democrat all my life. I think I'll stay.
Yeah, but until it hurts them, until a policy hurts them directly, I just don't, I think you're always going to get that. And mm-hmm. Again, it goes to why I brought it up. I think, that must be an omen. The lights just went off in my office. Oh, they just went back on. Okay. Nice. Talk about confusion. No, it makes the job, if you think it's, you come to this job and you get to just play legislator, mm-hmm. well, then you're in the wrong place. Because this is, you are psychologist, psychiatrist, you're the somebody's representative, their advocate, and you got to maintain. You talk about the campaign trail. David, every day in this job is an interview, right? It is. That's what you got to do. And I think the ones that have a problem are the ones that aren't willing to do that at the level that you got to do it.
Mm. Now, you mentioned a little earlier about a reconciliation bill. Was that on Obamacare?
Yeah, Obamacare and Planned Parenthood. I mean, I'll tell you, I was frustrated with it. I don't know what you'll hear from others. I really struggled with that vote because, first off, with this president, it's not going anywhere. Right. And I know people like to claim that, just get it to his desk and make him veto it so all of America can see what he stands for. And I like to tell them, okay, well, we did that with Keystone. Mm-hmm. The Keystone Pipeline passed both chambers and made it to his desk, and he vetoed it. And what did we hear? I heard crickets.
Yeah,
I didn't hear any big uproar and all this. So I don't expect anything more to come of the reconciliation bill. Plus, it was only half a loaf, right? And maybe this is why Jim DeMint and his crew didn't like it. We're not going to be able to get rid of this thing under any circumstance until the guy in the White House is gone. Once he is gone, then we got to start to, get the pride out of the way, the pride of someone's idea not working. We got to look at the reality, which is we have premiums skyrocketing, health insurance premiums skyrocketing. People are paying major deductibles, which, by the way, if you'll remember before the Obamacare law was passed, the argument of why we needed to move towards nationalized health care was because people were going bankrupt, remember?
Yep.
All of these medical bills are driving them into bankruptcy and putting them in soup lines. Well, I got news for you. If you got a family of five and you got a $10,000 deductible, that is even worse than the situation that preceded. We should have addressed the insurance problem instead of the health care issue. But that part aside, I'm ranting. I didn't like the fact that we were only taking out certain pieces of Obamacare, because it suggests that we're okay with the other ones. People aren't going to understand, like you said, Jim, you can tell them all day long, well, we can only send the money stuff over there. We can't send the policy because reconciliation is very narrow how you can use it. And if you put any policy in it, then the Senate parliamentarian will say, this doesn't qualify for reconciliation. You're going to need 60 votes to get it through the Senate, and it's not going to happen. That was first. Second was the Planned Parenthood stuff. I just think we got a much bigger job to do with Planned Parenthood. And talk about a disconnect with the American public. How can anyone sit on the other side of this argument and say that, whether you like Planned Parenthood or not, the fact remains they were selling human body parts. When did our culture start to accept this type of dark behavior? And the slippery slope that puts you on where you had, forget about medical ethics issues. Let's just talk about morality. I mean, what's the future, right? And I think we got a much bigger thing to do in tucking it in this bill. Anyway, it passed. There were 11 Republicans that voted against it. It passed overwhelmingly, and we'll see what the Senate does this week.
Mm. It does go up to them?
Yeah, it goes. But if it qualifies, unless the parliamentarian finds something, and these guys, it was Paul Ryan, John Klein, and Fred Upton from Michigan. Those were the committee chairmen for the committees of jurisdiction. Klein, Education and Workforce Committee, Upton, Energy and Commerce Committee, and Paul Ryan, the Ways and Means Chair. they spent a lot of time crafting this thing and working with the parliamentary offices to make sure that it could make it with just the 50 plus one votes. It'll go to the Senate this week. The Senate, if it fits the reconciliation thing, you would hope that with 54 Republican senators, we would get at least 51 Republican votes to get it to the president's desk. But we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. I think that's where most people's following of what goes on in Congress stops when you start talking about numbers. The public seems to have been programmed to think in terms of who's ahead by how many percent, and that's the extent of the deep thinking. There's not much that goes on beyond that. There was a continuing resolution agreed on a couple of weeks ago. There's a deficit cliff coming up fairly shortly. Jack Lew is saying that we're going to run out of money on the, what is the third, next
November
Tuesday?
November 3rd, yeah. Tuesday?
Is that next Tuesday already?
Next Wednesday, somewhere in there.
Wow. And it seems like that's happening faster and faster. I think this is like the fifth or sixth time since Obama's been in office. But it happened a lot more in Reagan's time. At least that's what I've heard. That we've reached the deficits or the deficit limit and had to vote for an increase. Is that what you remember?
I lost you. It froze up, and I lost your voice when you said it seemed like it happened more during Reagan. But all I can tell you is the continuing resolution. I voted against it. It wasn't a vote against it because of Planned Parenthood. We'd already voted to defund Planned Parenthood. I voted against it because they got to stop managing crises around here. Nobody ever asked me. You knew that you were going to have a budget due by September 30th when we got sworn in on January 6th. And nobody even talked about it until a week or two before we were going to have this CR vote. That's not the way you should run this place. They got to start making a case for the American public as to what we're doing and why we're doing it. If you want the American people not only to want to participate, but to maybe have some understanding.
Yeah, Tom, we're losing contact. If you would.
All right, so I was just saying about the CR, why I voted against it. The debt limit, I think the saddest part of the debt limit is because it's my understanding, I could be a little off on this, but the Cromnibus bill that the prior Congress voted on a year ago, the lame duck Congress, that bill actually took the debt limit off. Most of the American public doesn't know that until it wasn't reinstated, I don't think, until March maybe. Last March, and now you're right, we're going to run out of money on November 3rd, and lo and behold, I've been here for 10 months, and nobody here within the Republican Conference has asked me where I'm at on a debt ceiling vote. I just this is no way to run a railroad or the House of Representatives, and I think they're going to have a problem passing it. We'll see.
Tom, I've got a question for you. I think David's still there. He just cut his video so that we could assist the audio there. Last time we talked to you, it was January. You had just arrived in Washington as a freshman congressman. I'm curious, and I know this might take a lot of compromising here, a lot of finding middle ground. But as you now have 10 months under your belt as a congressman, what has surprised you most about the change in your life, positive and negative, with respect to being now in Washington?
What's changed in my life? Mostly just the commute. You know, when I was in my prior life, I used to put 30,000 miles on the car a year, traveling from North Dakota to Wisconsin and everywhere in between. And I think about people every day, Jim, who are out peddling stuff, you know, salespeople. Mm-hmm. They get in their car on Monday morning and they get home on Friday night, or they got to fly somewhere on a regular basis. It's really no different in this case. You know, I got on a plane last night. I'll be here until Thursday afternoon, and I'll head back. You spend about 60% of your time in the district, about 40% here. The only thing you got to get used to is the size of this institution. I mean, it's just staggering. I thought my legislative experience would make this a much more gentle transition. You know, I came from a body with 201 total legislators in the state of Minnesota. That's the House and the Senate. You got a population in the state of, I think the last census was 5.3 million. I get here, and it's suddenly 535 in both chambers. And you're actually answering to a population of over 300 million. And when people, you know, we used to get emails back at home when I was in the legislature. I'll give you an example. They wanted to build a Viking stadium, which they finally got. But we would get emails, and you would get hundreds of them, right? Well, I got news for you. Now when they want to unleash their lists, they are sending emails, action emails to hundreds of thousands of people. And it just, it's amazing the response that you get. So that's first. I have, though, the ball started to slow down for me, baseball lingo, probably March. Started to get my feet underneath me. And I think the most amazing thing that I learned, one, Republicans got to do a much better job of managing this institution if they're going to govern and running it. And that means they got to build their case from the date when you're going to vote. In other words, if you're going to have a budget due on September 30th, you got to start building that case on January 6th. You don't manage it in the last week before the vote and then complain that people at home don't understand what you're doing. You haven't given them any chance to do it. And we got to have more of a long-term, a very strategic approach as to what our policies are, how to help people, and how we're going to move them forward. That's on the Republican side. On the Democrat side, amazing to me. I knew when I came here that this executive, the president, was not going to have relationships with Republicans. He made it very clear from day one that he has disdain for Republicans, and he doesn't generally do any deals with Republicans. What was the most amazing thing, Jim, is he doesn't have relationships with his own party. You look at why, just think back 7 years now, he's been in office. In 7 years, this administration, this president has passed two major pieces of legislation through the people's process. In other words, through the legislative process. It's a difficult process. It's supposed to be. Because you want people to work these ideas through. You don't want anybody's whim, anybody's new idea just to suddenly become law. The founders intended that this is supposed to be a bottom-up process, and it is like making sausage. At times, it can be very messy. This president hasn't been able to build those relationships or has chosen not to on his own side of the aisle. So instead of trying to learn and work with the legislative process as the founders intended, this guy, he's hired the best and the brightest for 7 years to figure out how to circumvent the Constitution and get around the rule of law. That's been the most amazing thing to me is that, you know, we see it from afar and we think, boy, this guy, he has disdain for the Constitution. He doesn't want to follow it. Well, it's more simple than that, Jim. He can't follow it because the guy he won't build the relationships to do the job.
But isn't it true that the key people in the Senate have simply aided and abetted this whole process?
I mean, you can say Harry Reid certainly gave him cover. Everybody's given him cover. You know, there's no doubt that when you don't let this stuff get to his desk, he doesn't have to be accountable for his inability to manage and govern himself. Look at that dinner, Harry Reid. Right? Harry Reid made a decision before the last election that he wasn't going to let the Democrat-controlled Senate vote on anything that might have to go to the president's desk and put him in an awkward position, and they lost their majority. I think this is a lesson, frankly, that Mitch McConnell should be paying attention to. Mm-hmm. Mitch McConnell needs to show America, because those of us in the House, we just naturally get lumped in with the Senate. So you don't know all the stuff we're doing in the House because it stops. It goes to the Senate and it dies, right? Mm-hmm. I think we as Republicans, again, gets back to that piece. We got to start governing, which means you need to send these things, these our ideas, to the president's desk, and you need to show America what this place would be like if we had a Republican president.
Yeah, excellent point.
One of this summer I was up in Emily, which is northern Minnesota. You know where
sure.
Emily is, and I was in a gas station and just kind of walking around looking at stuff, and Rick Nolan happened to be there, and Rick and I probably chatted for about an hour. just, you know, on and off stuff. And in the conversation, his phone rang, but he had two of them. And he says, well, this one didn't ring again. This one's the one that goes directly to the president. And I've had it for 2 years now, and it hasn't rung yet. So just hitchhiking on what you said. He's not building the relationships, even with those people in his own party.
That's right.
Yeah, Rick said it as a kind of a joke, a kind of a cast-off. But the truth underneath and behind it was, yeah, the guy doesn't reach out.
No.
Yeah,
no, he doesn't talk. Yeah, and he's not given us any indication he's going to, David.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think 7 years. 7 years is enough history that we should learn that he's who he is and what he's not going to do. I'm getting the wave from Becky next to me that I got to get going to the next thing. Okay. You guys got anything you want to wrap it up with?
One final question. And you know, I'm just starting reading a book about the growth of the left and the division in the nation and all the rest of that. And every once in a while you hear some commentator say that we've reached the end, we've reached the point of no return, it can't go back, something drastic has to happen. Have we reached that point yet, or is it just a lot of noise that we're paying a lot of attention to, you know, the doomsdayers of the world? Is there hope?
Yeah, I think there is, David. I mean, first off, I think it was Ronald Reagan that said we're always one generation away from losing our freedom as we know it. And I mean that not in the exact words, but that's the quote as I remember. The point being that it's our freedom; we own it. This is a system of government that it only works if the citizens are educated and willing to participate in it. Now, that means that you get, what is it, Winston Churchill might be the one that's attributed this quote, that the people of a democracy get exactly what they deserve, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, there's always risk where we got to start paying attention to our liberties, our privacy issues, all of our personal stuff. But I'm going to tell you, I've been doing this for 10 years now. I'm not the doomsday prognosticator. I believe that the future is really bright. I think we're going to have some issues. There's no question that this is ugly. We are in a generational change in this country. Leadership is changing very fast. We got 247 Republican members of the U.S. House of Representatives, largest majority since 1928, which on its own, to me, is not very impressive. What is impressive, more than 50% of us have been elected in just the last 6 years. This thing is changing incredibly fast. And if we take anything from what will happen this week, which is John Boehner stepping down, and whether it's Paul Ryan or someone else stepping up, you and I literally are witnessing a generational change in American politics. And I think it bodes well for the future. Now we just got to give young people a reason to participate.
All right. I'm encouraged as well. I think that the Freedom Caucus and John Boehner and Paul Ryan and all of it is a good thing. Thanks, Tom.
Congressman, you've been very generous with your time. Thank you. I hope we can do this again before long, and have a great day in Washington, okay?
We will. Thanks. You guys too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Congressman Tom Emmer from Minnesota. And we're back to music, thankfully.
Really?
Well, the system's working now. I got it back.
Wow.